Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for mid-February 2023. The global carbon dioxide levels are 419.84 parts per million, well above the 350 parts per million that scientists say we should be at. Also, there are only 2,506 days left until the year 2030, the date by which we must cut our carbon dioxide emissions in half. It's kind of scary. In a week, it'll be less than 2,499 days, so the clock keeps ticking. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing very well, and I am looking forward to talking with Andrew Posner today. I'm enthusiastic to talk to Andrew Posner today, who says that interest rates are a climate issue, and he discusses ways that nonprofits like his Capital Good Fund can get more people engaged with renewable energy.
Well, you know, Mariah, in climate stuff, money talks, right? You need money to do many of the things that climate change requires. And this is particularly true in terms of people's homes, and it takes money to become green often enough. Major segments of the population don't have the money to change their lifestyle to be more green, to have all the sort of technology that's around. On top of that, in the United States, unfortunately, outright poverty is endemic. It's everywhere. It's shocking that in the year 2023, America countenances the level of poverty that we in fact have. So it turns out that there is, over the last 10 years, there are some moves to try and address the question of poverty in particular, and the finance around poverty, the financial well-being of people in poverty. And that, of course, connects to climate change, because it's a climate issue. Everything's a climate issue, but this one is also an issue where people of limited means, how are they going to get in, shall we say, the climate game? How are they going to actually live lives? And long story short, in 2008 or so, an enterprising young guy at Brown University founded a corporation, a nonprofit, I should say, with the explicit aim of ending poverty by helping disadvantaged communities understand their finances better and come to terms with it, essentially learn more about the financial system and their own financial state in the world. We are fortunate to be joined by that smart young guy from Brown University, Mr. Andy Posner, who founded something called Capital Good Fund in 2009, right? And this has the goal of helping low-income Americans escape from poverty. Andy, welcome aboard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I look forward to chatting.
That's great. I should say in passing that in addition to being a financial whiz, Andy is also a poet. He has won prizes for poetry, won the 2019 Pushcart Poetry Prize for his book of poetry. So it's wonderful to have you on board, someone who combines all of these different skills, Andy. Tell me, I talked a little bit about Capital Good Fund. Did I get the story anywhere near right? Or please tell me, what should people know about Capital Good Fund?
Yeah, and I should note, nominated for a pushcart. Oh, I didn't win.
Close enough for me.
For all those listeners who are experts in the pushcart prize, they would have said, no, that's not accurate. So happy to tell a little bit about Capital Good Fund, because I think we have an interesting story that has become more relevant over time, because we operate or try to operate at the climate. So back in 2008, I moved to Rhode Island for a graduate program in environmental studies at Brown. And there were a lot of things swirling in the air back then. There was the green collar jobs movement was just starting to emerge. It was a book by Van Jones on that topic. And there was also, there were a lot of emergent financing mechanisms, things like property assessed clean energy and on-bill financing. And so I got really interested in that as a means of unlocking the potential of clean energy and energy efficiency. And then at the same time, there was the financial collapse of 2008 that got me interested in trying to understand what is it about the financial system that when it goes awry can really hurt people? And what is it about the financial system that when done right can uplift people and advance a climate-friendly movement? And I should say, I don't have a background in financial services, so I really had to try to understand these things. And that's when I started doing research and interviews with community members in Providence, Rhode Island, and learned about the issue of predatory lending, learned about just how endemic, as you noted, poverty is, learned about energy poverty and environmental justice and all those issues. And so when I started Capital Good Fund, we had and still have two components to our mission. One is to create pathways out of poverty. The other is to advance a green economy. And the way that we do that is through financial services, both financial coaching and, more centrally, lending. And I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear of the idea of a nonprofit lender. We are what's called a Community Development Financial Institution, or CDFI, which is a U.S. Treasury certification. And there's well over 1,000 of us around the country, and many are nonprofits. And we exist to get capital into underserved communities where traditional market players either don't lend or lend at high interest rates.
Andy, can I just interrupt for one second before you go on? People use the term financial services, right? Can you, in simplistic terms, is that as simple as making loans to people? Is that what financial services is, or does it encompass a bigger set of things?
Definitely encompasses a bigger set of things. So financial services can include, you know, banking services, insurance, financial advice, investing, that sort of thing. We're not a bank or credit union, so we don't take deposits or offer checking accounts, that sort of thing. We just focus on providing loans to low to moderate income families and families of color and financial coaching.
And when you say capital, I mean, that, again, that's a big word, right? Capital, typically you mean the money to buy important things. Is that fair as well? Just so my own sort of education here, I want to make sure I'm with you, right?
Yeah, I mean, so specifically when I say capital, I mean, we make loans to families for three categories of needs. One of them is residential solar, battery storage, and energy efficiency measures. The other one is for immigration expenses, for things like applying for citizenship, a green card, family petition. And, you know, initially I didn't think there was a climate connection here, but we know that migration due to climate induced stress and events is going to increase. And those people, when they come, if they come to the US, they will need financing to afford legal help to win their case. And then the last category of needs is just really small dollar, under $1,500 for things like rent, utilities, car repair, security deposits, the kind of day-to-day things that trip people up that might induce them to or make them need to go to a payday lender and pay 500% interest on a loan or go to a loan shark or what have you.
Interesting. Okay, good.
So yeah, and then, you know, just to give a sense of scale, we've been around 14 years. We just had our 14th birthday. We're coming up on $30 million lent out to 11,000 families, with a over 96% repayment rate, despite, you know, 90% of our clients being low income, average FICO scores being in the low 600s. And so, you know, basically when I got started, all the people in the know said that it wouldn't work. And thus far, I've been very proud to prove them wrong. But now we're in a really interesting moment in terms of growth and new opportunities. We lend in 10 states, but I imagine we'll want to talk a lot about, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act and how that's going to impact our green lending in particular.
I just want to go back for one second. You said that when you started out, wise heads said that you would not have the repayment rate, the 96% success rate in getting in closing the loans, right? That you wouldn't be getting the money back. Why do you think you've been successful? Is it a misreading of the wise people that told you that it wouldn't work, or is it something that you're doing?
Well, I think it's nothing particularly magical. I mean, it's a lot of our staff look like and speak the language of the people that we serve. We treat them with dignity and respect. We don't just look at a credit score. We We take a more holistic approach to when we review or underwrite a loan application. And we have really flexible and high quality customer service. So people trust us. You know, when you decide whether to make a payment to Capital Good Fund, it's very different than if it's just some faceless credit card company. Mm-hmm.
So it's basically the inherent goodness of the people that you're dealing with, right?
It's the relationships we've built. Yeah.
Yeah. Super. Okay. No, that's good. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about kind of the Inflation Reduction Act and where we are now vis-a-vis our green lending. So, you know, it's really interesting because when we got started, at the time, solar was extraordinarily expensive and certainly was not even in the realm of possibility for low to moderate families. But now we're in an environment in which the price of solar has gone way down. And now, thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, the tax credit is 30%. And then the cost of other key technologies are also coming down, heat pumps and all that good stuff. But the issue is that, for example, the solar tax credit, the Inflation Reduction Act brought that from 26% back to 30%, but it didn't make it refundable, which means that it's a credit. So if you don't have taxable income, then you can't benefit from the credit. And, you know, that's something that's very typical of our policy environment is that it tends to be stacked towards people that already have money. Right, just like the mortgage interest deduction benefits people who can afford a mortgage and buy a house. But it's a big problem when it comes to adoption of solar. When you look at the percentage of homeowners that have solar that are low to moderate income, it's about 20%, even though 40% of homeowners are low to moderate income. So they're significantly underrepresented. And that's due to a lot of factors, but the tax credit is a big one. Basically, if you are wealthy, you are paying less for your solar than you are if you are not wealthy. And in fact, the same is true with the EV, electric vehicle tax credit, because it's the same thing. If you buy, let's say you put up a $10,000 solar system or you buy a $30,000 car, and your tax credit is going to be $7,500 on the car. If you have no taxable income, that credit doesn't do you any good. That car costs you the same. Whereas if you have the taxable income, you get the benefit. So that's something that really needs to be addressed. And we'll talk in a second about how we're looking to address that. But that tax credit thing is an issue across the board because there are narrow tax credits for doing weatherization and heat pumps and all that thing, but they're always credits, not rebates or refunds. But the other challenges have to do with how installers and other stakeholders are reaching Black and brown communities and lower income communities. And this is perhaps an even bigger challenge than the tax credit. If you look at who owns the solar installation companies, they don't tend to be owned by the communities that we're trying to reach. And these installers don't want to target communities because if you're looking at your addressable market, you know that lower-income communities are likely to have lower credit. They're likely to have smaller houses, so the ticket sizes are going to be lower, and you might have higher approval rates. So it's just a lot easier to go into whiter, more affluent neighborhoods. The problem is, obviously, we can't tackle the climate crisis if we don't address more of the housing stock. What's more, it's the families that Capital Good Fund serves that struggle the most with rising energy prices and would benefit the most from clean energy if they could access it. And then also, if the communities that we want to reach don't benefit from clean energy, it's hard to expect them to continue to support decarbonization policies moving forward. So there are many, many reasons to solve for how you get more solar batteries and EVs and heat pumps into low-income homes. And by the way, we're not even talking about renters right now. We're talking about low-income homeowners. Renters are even another challenge. So that's what we've been trying to solve for the last 14 years. And in particular, we only started doing solar lending in late 2021. We've been doing energy efficiency almost since day one. All sorts of directions we can take, but that's just sort of the problem statement.
And it's a fascinating question about the fact that you have to have money to make money, in the sense that if you don't have enough of a tax burden to be bigger than the credit you're getting, then it's lost on you. That's a real problem for people who don't have who aren't paying a lot of taxes or don't have the income to pay a lot of taxes, right?
Correct. It's a fundamental problem with how we set up the incentive structure for a lot of things, including clean energy.
It's probably a blind spot in the federal government that loves tax policy as the way to do everything, right?
Well, it goes back, it harkens back to a mistrust of people that are less well off, that if you just give them a check, they'll misuse it or there'll be a lot of fraud. And it's also this odd notion that there's a difference between someone not having to pay a tax, that bill that they owe, you know, offsetting it versus cutting a check. At the end of the day, it's the same fiscal impact, but it feels different.
And the solar loans that you give are very low interest rate. And then does the return on investment, does that help get those loans paid back as well?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because this is kind of working into some of the economics of this. So certainly the interest rates that we charge, which are quite low, make the economics more feasible for a low-income homeowner. You know, because this is one of the main problems, is that with solar, you have to make the monthly loan payment less than your current utility bill. And there's only so many ways that you can get there. First of all, you really have to make it a 20, 25-year loan term, which in our case, it's 25 years. That's a long time for somebody to take out debt. It's also a long time for somebody to invest money in us to fund the loan, because we have to borrow the money that we lend out. So that creates a challenge. That's a long period of time during which things can go wrong. Economy can get worse. People can lose their jobs, et cetera. And then now in this interest rate environment where investors are expecting to earn 7% on their investment, you know, there's not really a way to charge 3% on a solar loan and pay 7% to your investors. And yet you can only raise rates so much before the loan payment begins to exceed what the current utility bill is. So I've written a lot about how the solar lenders do it currently. A lot of the big fintech players, financial technology players like GoodLeap and Mosaic. And so I'll explain it, because it's a big problem. And I think at some point it's going to come under scrutiny. Basically, the way that the other lenders make the economics work for themselves is they do a couple things. The first one is they charge a hidden dealer fee. So let's say you have a $10,000 solar system. Unbeknownst to the client, if they choose to finance it, the installer will actually tack on $3,000 and tell them it's a $13,000 system. So the customer has no way of knowing that it's actually $13,000 instead of $10,000. There's a cash price basically and a finance price. And then they'll tell you, oh, but it's at, you know, 2.99% interest. But it's actually not, right? Because they're not disclosing or factoring in that fee into the APR, which I think is a violation of the Truth in Lending Act, but it's very prevalent. Now, the reason they do that is because the solar lenders know that most people are not going to keep the loan for 25 years. Most people are going to pay some of it down when they get the tax credit. Maybe they have a windfall, or they sell the home and they pay off the loan. And if they pay off the loan early, the effective return is much higher. Because basically, you know, the solar lender is paying out $10,000 and you're paying them back $13,000, even if you paid it off in one day. And so I get it. Like, that's how they can achieve more economic yield. But because it's so opaque, the homeowner doesn't have a way to make an informed decision. So the way that we've solved for that is we've said, all right, let's just be transparent about the need for these fees. And we offer two options. So one is we charge $799 with no closing fee. So if it's a $10,000 system, it's a $10,000 loan and you pay $799. You know, that's a little high. So your starting loan payment is going to be higher. But if you're planning to pay off the loan early, that's a good option. But if you really want to get your loan payment down under your current utility bill, we will then allow you to pay a 20% closing fee, fully disclosed, rolled into the loan. So you're going to borrow $12,000, and that brings down the interest rate to 3.99. That's like points on a mortgage. It's called a buy down. And that significantly lowers your monthly payment. And now the homeowner can say, all right, I'm planning to keep the home for at least 7 years, 10 years, and therefore this makes more sense to me over time. From our vantage point, we know that some people will pay it off earlier, some people will pay it off later, but on balance, it does allow us to earn a little bit more than if we just charge 3.99 or 4.99 APR with no closing fee. And I know that's a little bit in the weeds, but it's important to understand, because there's sort of this balance of like economic return for the investor and for the lender, and transparency and getting panels on the roofs and making this work for homeowners. And it's very difficult, but we're getting to a point now where all the low-hanging fruit, all the affluent homeowners who were going to go solar are kind of have been reached. And as we start to reach the next segment of homeowners or next segments, we can't afford a scenario in which the industry gets this reputation of being, having no transparency. You know, these installers, a lot of them are charging random fees for the same systems. You might see one system that's $3 per watt. So a 10 kilowatt system might be $30,000 or it might be $40,000. And sometimes it just seems to depend on which sales rep you speak to. So that's another thing that we're trying to solve for, is to standardize these things. But then even beyond that, there's a question of, well, how do you reach these communities? Because right now, if you ask, you know, a low-income family about solar, they probably will have heard about it because some random person knocked on their door trying to sell them on, quote, free solar. And that is a widely held belief about the industry, that it's shady, that they're making these promises that can't be kept. So it's this, we have this incredible technology that can save families money, but between how it's marketed, how it's financed, to whom it's marketed, it's not necessarily reaching those communities. You know, our solution is we've partnered with several dozen phenomenal installers that are, you know, tend to be smaller, more family-run enterprises that don't engage in those shady practices. We have the transparent pricing that I mentioned. But also, because we're a nonprofit, our, you know, quote, investors, the people that lend us money, are not expecting the same return as those that invest in the for-profit market. And, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that interest rates are a climate issue. I mean, this is particularly noteworthy in the international context, where, you know, if a country in Africa or Latin America has to pay 12% to finance a solar array, it doesn't work. But if they pay 8%, it can. And similarly, if an investor lends us money at 5%, we can make it work. If they require 7%, we cannot. Even that 2 percentage point difference can make or break it. And so I think people need to understand that if they want to achieve climate action, and in particular climate justice, the returns that they require have to be adjusted accordingly, or else you're going to sort of almost force practices that perhaps are not aligned with justice.
So that raises for me the question of something I've heard about but do not understand very well. I believe it's called a green bank. And I think there's a proposal here in Massachusetts to establish a green bank at the state level. But my understanding is also that a federal green bank would be basically backed by the U.S. government. They'd print money to meet all the obligations, and then they could accept a lower interest rate because of the securities, like buying a treasury bill. Is that something that would benefit, to your point about the interest rates being a climate issue? Is a green bank that offered lower interest rates on a long term but with great assurance of safety, is that a way forward?
Yeah. So the Inflation Reduction Act did a lot of great things. I talked about how it didn't make the tax credit refundable, but it did do a lot of other things. One of the things that it did was that it set aside $27 billion for what's called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And it's being administered at the Environmental Protection Agency. And a lot of that money will be flowing through to green banks, as well as community lenders like us, or intermediaries that then lend to or grant money to organizations like us. Green banks are interesting because it's not like a legal definition. They can take different forms. In Rhode Island, there's the Rhode Island Infrastructure Bank. Colorado has the Colorado Clean Energy Fund. Typically, they're independent but receive some allocation of funding from the state. But they can take different forms. But basically, what they exist to do is to take private dollars and leverage it to bring additional private capital to green initiatives. And one of the ways that it can do that is through what are called credit enhancements. So, for example, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund money, it could be used to provide a loan loss reserve. So we might go out and say, all right, we need to raise $10 million to fund X number of solar loans in Massachusetts. And in order to bring our borrowing costs from 7 to 5, we need $1 million of guarantee. So in other words, we go to the investor and we say, if we lose $1 million, that first $1 million that would be covered by the loan loss reserve or the loan guarantee. And those are things that green banks and other entities can provide. And they can also provide debt, which is called first loss debt, which means that if there's a default, their loss, they cover it first. Or they can just provide lower cost interest, lower cost debt that brings the total cost of the whole pool, excuse me, the pool down. But yes, those are the kinds of things that will be done because the federal government understands that, that borrowing costs are a huge issue here.
And that's interesting because, I mean, somehow I got it in my head that the Green Bank would be loaning to individual residences, right? But at least in what you just described, the Green Banks would be basically backing other organizations that would be making the specific loans to a particular address in a town to put photovoltaics on the roof.
It can do both. The Connecticut, there's also the Connecticut Green Bank, which itself issues green bonds, so it raises lower cost capital. But typically, what they do is they'll leverage their balance sheet to enable more activity. They can lend directly to businesses. The Rhode Island Infrastructure Bank lends to cities and towns. So it can take a lot of different forms. But I think, you know, for example, in Colorado, the Colorado Clean Energy Fund wants to work with us because we're well suited to reaching underserved families, and they are not. Like, that's not their expertise. But there's a lot of flexibility in the Green Bank model because it's a sort of quasi-governmental public-private partnership model that's really, really interesting and innovative. The other thing that the Inflation Reduction Act does to advance work in underserved communities is, I mean, it has a lot of things. One of the things it does is it increases the tax credit if a project is in certain communities. For example, they've defined what are called energy communities, which are still being, I don't think they've come out with a full list of census tracts, but it's communities where coal plants have recently been closed or where a certain percentage of revenue comes from oil and gas. And I think there's a third definition. But if you do a project in one of those communities, the solar tax credit goes from 30% to 40%. And that's just, I mean, those are just a couple of examples. It's a really good piece of legislation in terms of making sure that we don't just reduce emissions, but do so equitably.
Yeah, I mean, the concept that the financing of helping people get these solar panels is a climate. It's a big, big issue for people that have less money. Probably, well, do you find? So here's a question that, again, to my naivety, the communities that you deal with in this sense, are they sophisticated financially and grasp at all what these sort of, you know, what do you call it, points on your loan, all these kind of financial technology terminology? Is that something that is easily translated? Do you find that is an issue or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a common notion that or concern that lower income folks are not financially sophisticated. However, if you think about it, to be low income in America means and survive, you have to be more financially savvy. You have to know how to make every penny last. You have to know how to weed out this offer versus that offer and which one's predatory and which one isn't. You have to navigate a whole hornet's nest of local, state, and federal programs and application forms and thresholds, et cetera. So, no, I think, I mean, you know, the term points on a mortgage may not be familiar to everybody, but that's not really an income thing. It's more just
I would say it's not something I'm particularly familiar with. So it's not a,
correct.
You know, I mean, this stuff can be opaque.
So. Correct. But the issue is just that, you know, that they're busy. And so solar is not something you can do quickly. I mean, the big lenders, the Good Leaps of the world, have done a really good job of making it where you can click a button and enter a little bit of information or other way around and then get a decision instantly. The issue is that doesn't work well if you're trying to make a quick decision on somebody who doesn't have a perfect credit score, for example, which many of our clients don't. If they don't have perfect credit, you do need to look at other factors. But that takes a little bit more time. And We were just talking before we started recording about, I recently wrote a blog post about how long it has taken Capital Good Fund to put solar up on our roof. Not to put it on the roof, but to actually get permission to operate. I mean, it's been like a year. It's an outlier. But we do need to streamline this process because while you know the contractor handles most of the work, it's still stressful as a homeowner. I've put solar on several homes that I've owned and sold, and it's a bit of a pain in the buchas, you know? Yeah, yeah. And part of it is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory has something called the Solar App Plus, which can streamline the permitting process with cities and towns, but very few, in fact, I don't think any in Massachusetts have adopted it. And that's something that can make the experience better for homeowners, improve margins for installers, and bring down costs. Because you know these days, basic solar panels, very reliable, efficient, but you know not your premium panels, cost like 30 cents a watt. And yet many homeowners are paying $3, $4, $5, $6 a watt for their panels. And so a lot of that is the permitting time and the customer acquisition time. And so there's a lot we can do to streamline that.
What, so remind me, you are, what parts of the country do you service? You began in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, but now you're becoming more national. Do you have a plan to expand? What's up with that?
Yeah, we do. We lend in 10 states. We offer our green loans in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Texas. And there are a lot of other markets to which we plan to expand. In particular, as we look to launch probably our most exciting new initiative, which is actually a solar lease. So, you know, I mentioned the issue of the tax credit. Interestingly enough, the Inflation Reduction Act actually has a provision that can solve for that, which is it says that if you are a nonprofit and you own solar panels, you can, for the first time, receive the tax credit via what they call direct pay. Previously, if you were a nonprofit, you also don't pay taxes, the tax credit wouldn't do any good. Well, what we realized was that meant that if we leased the panels to the homeowner, meaning we own them, it's installed on their roof, and they pay us a lease payment, but we maintain the panels, we can now claim the credit ourselves. That's never existed before. And that's a game changer because now it means that we can pass that savings on to the homeowner, keep a little bit of it for our cost, and then use the rest to be able to borrow the funds we need to make the projects, you know, to pay for the projects. So we've done all sorts of financial modeling. It is a multi-billion-dollar opportunity to finally get solar into these communities. And we're hoping to launch it in the next couple of months in new markets, including in Georgia, where we have a lot of buy-in from cities and towns. And it's a state where there's not a lot of residential solar happening.
That's fascinating. So basically, you would be, in a sense, the middleman to get the money as a nonprofit, but then distribute it to the people who have the solar panels on their roofs, right? As a way to short circuit this issue of the tax credit mechanism that everyone that is typically used, right? Is that a fair statement?
Correct. Yes, exactly. That if you are a homeowner and you own the panels, it's called the Section 25 tax credit, which is the residential, and that's only up to 30%. The commercial credit, like if you go to Sunrun or what have you, Sunnova, and take out a lease, they're doing that under the Section 48 commercial credit where they own the panels and they get the credit. For-profits have to do this complicated tax equity structure, and a lot of the economic value gets siphoned off by the transaction costs and the investors. Suddenly, we can come out, we don't have all those transaction costs, we are going to get a check from the IRS, we're still waiting on details of how that'll work, but it'll be a lot simpler. And now we can pass not all of the tax credit, we have to keep some for ourselves for our costs, but most of the savings can accrue to the homeowner to bring down their starting lease payment. And also, if the homeowner sells the home, instead of taking out a 25-year loan, which is very daunting for anyone, especially a low-income homeowner, now you're saying, look, you don't have to worry about maintaining the panels. If you sell the home, you don't have to pay off the system. You can transfer it to the new owner. You still save a little bit more money if you do have enough income to claim the credit and own it. But that's not the only consideration, right? There's also this thing about selling your home and financing. So it's really exciting. And I don't know that was the intent, the legislative intent. I think they were thinking, you know, if you're a church and you want to put up solar, they want you to be able to get the credit. But this ability to do a nonprofit lease is just truly game changing. And now that energy community adder, for example, if we do in a certain community a solar project, we could get a 40% tax credit. And suddenly adding batteries becomes economical, and it just opens a lot of doors. And now you layer in the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund and other pools of money to bring down your borrowing costs and the like. And now you have 10 years in which to completely remake the country for the better.
I heard someone say that every technical innovation, like a solar panel, has to be accompanied by a business model innovation in order to take advantage of it. And I think what you're describing are these sort of innovative ways that that we can take advantage of the technology and distribute it and get it to people so that it actually works. I mean, that's great. That's great.
Well, it's business model and public policy. I mean, all of this is enabled by good public policy. I mean, for, you know, we're on the energy efficiency side in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. We are a heat loan lender, meaning you can get an interest-free loan from us to put in a heat pump and insulation and remove knob and tube wiring or what have you. And that's because of a program that is funded through a surcharge on everyone's utility bill that goes into a pot of money that basically pays the interest to us, and the homeowner just pays the principal. And we've done, I think we're up to $12 million of energy efficiency loans in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And we're doing increasingly more heat pumps as part of that program. So it's business model plus technology plus public policy.
Wow. Well, if someone wanted to find out more about Capital Good Fund, where would they go? What's the website? I mean, how can people be involved in this project if they like it?
Yeah, so they can go to capitalgoodfund.org. There are a number of ways to get involved. If you are a solar installer and want to partner with us, please reach out. We're looking to grow our network. If you are an impact investor or philanthropist, we are raising debt and we're also raising grants. We are growing our board of directors, looking for advisors and volunteers. So folks can go to our website, or they can also reach out to me directly. I don't know if maybe you could put my contact information in the show notes, but particularly with the solar leasing program, which is truly a multi-billion dollar opportunity to really reach low-income folks. We're going to need some help with that and encourage people to get involved.
Super, super, super. Well, I think what we will do is put this information on the blog, the show page for this, right? That'll be on the Mass Climate Action website, which of course you go to massclimateaction.org, look across the top for newsletter and more. You pull that down, it says blog and podcast, and hiding in there are the show notes where you can find the links to Capital Good, plus other stuff we'll put on it. Maybe we'll put a link to the Pushcart Poetry nomination, so people can see learn more about your poetry. If you have any questions or show ideas, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about in shows going forward. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using Stitcher or one of the modern podcast distribution apps like Google or Apple or Spotify or blah, blah, blah. We're on all of them. Please ask your friends to listen to us on their favorite podcast distribution app, because that can be your climate action for the week. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support to keep us updated on all the important things that are happening. We want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that protects and respects environmental justice communities. So, Andy, thank you so much for coming and giving us this fascinating discussion about the good work you're doing.
Thank you. I'm always happy to talk clean energy.
That's great. And Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.